for a whole generation or two, we were on the fast track to giving up on 3 out of the 5 conservative principles. And you know what? I don't like what I saw. It was way back in 1534. I hope you're all going to remember that date from now on if you don't remember it normally. That Henry VIII, for good reasons and bad reasons, declares independence from Europe and sets the stage, gets the ball rolling for a new Protestant construction of Europe politically, based on independent nations. It takes a while for it to spread eastward. And eventually Europe and then America and other parts of the world, Israel, are reconstructed according to this vision of independent, self-determining national states. And we lived, the world lived more or less with this reality certainly through till 1945, with eruptions of imperial challengers, Napoleon, the Kaiser, Hitler, imperial challengers within Europe. As is obvious, that world of national states was restricted at first just to Europe. I mean, the European powers had, you know, no qualms while maintaining their own internal national state system among Christians, no qualms about going out and conquering, you know, South America or North America or Asia or Africa. So it isn't, I don't want to pretend that this was, you know, exactly a model that I would want to endorse. Certainly, those national states did plenty of nasty things. And I don't consider them to be some kind of a perfect world. They're not some kind of an ideal. We don't live in an ideal world. But I do think that we'd be mistaken if we didn't notice that the period of the Protestant construction for about 400 years really did create something astonishing and spectacular and important. The competition among nations created the world that we know in science, in art, in government. The forms of government that we know were developed through the competition of those national states. Right? So much of what it is that we consider to be positive and desirable about modernity is actually the result of a Protestant reconfiguration of the basic order of Europe, which then creates a competition. Some of what came out of that competition, like the worldwide competition of empire building, we don't like. You know, I don't think it fits within a healthy biblical point of view, and I don't think it fits within a healthy moral point of view. But much of what we do like is also the result of that competition. Now, as far as I'm concerned, the goal should have been to improve that world. But my opinion didn't win out. Nobody asked me. And that's not the way history went. After World War II, a devastated Europe decided to go in the direction of overcoming the order of national states. I mean, this is an old German dream. We can argue that to a certain extent it's also an old French dream. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. But that dream had its big moment after 400 years in 1945. When all sorts of wise people started saying, well, look, what are we going to do? the Germans just keep starting world wars. Some of the people most outspoken in saying that were the Germans. What can you do? We keep starting world wars. You got to keep us down. You got to find a way to keep us down. You can't just give us the tools to do that. And the idea of a united Europe, which would somehow suppress this problem and make it go away, became extremely popular, ever more popular. But look, most people weren't paying attention. Most people were paying attention to something else. After the war against fascism and Nazism was the Cold War, and decades of war struggle against Marxist totalitarianism, another empire trying to take over Europe and the rest of the world. So there's a big, big watershed in our history, in our personal history, all of ours, in 1989 when the Berlin Wall falls. Because after almost a century of struggle against different imperial powers, totalitarian, fascistic powers, suddenly there was no such enemy. It's 1990, and people look around, and they say, what are we going to do? Well, we know what they did. Although I was there at the time. At the time, it wasn't so clear that this was happening. But I remember to this day that when I heard President Bush talk about the New World Order in 1990.
We have before us the opportunity to forge for ourselves and for future generations a new world order, a world where the rule of law, not the law of the jungle, governs the conduct of nations.
Now, I was a young man then, and I remembered being astonished, being just shocked, like having like a chill ran down my spine. He says 100 generations of our forefathers failed, but now a new world is about to be born. And now we're going to replace the rule of the jungle with the rule of law. And I was astonished. I was just stunned. I was amazed. I felt like, wait a second, haven't we had enough of this? Well, we're doing this again? Right, but this is what happened. What happened was that for an entire generation, both Democrats and Republicans and the major political parties across Europe were all in agreement that this is what we should do. I mean, there were occasional rare, you know, voices saying the opposite. The most obvious was Margaret Thatcher. 1990, Margaret Thatcher, who was my hero. You know, I couldn't imagine somebody thinks the world would be better off without Thatcher, and they replaced her with John Major? But what was going on was this, that Thatcher was an actual nationalist. And she didn't believe that all of Europe needs to become a single entity, and she didn't believe that the whole world needs a single rule of law. She wasn't there. And then she was gone. And then we've had an entire generation where the leadership of the West, I'm not saying everybody agreed. I mean, there were still kind of like a left and a right and disagreeing about things, but there was no real debate. There was no debate about the most important issue of our time. And that most important issue of our time was the ending, the decision to end the order of national states, 4 centuries old, which had brought unprecedented economic and political and scientific well-being to the world. The decision to end it in favor of something that, you know, you can argue about how different it was from previous empires, but it was certainly some, let's say, two imperial projects. One, the European imperial project, which is kind of like Germany reboot, like the Germans get another chance to do this over again, they'll get it right this time. That's like, that's one imperial project. And then the big imperial project, Pax Americana. America's going to impose rule of law on the world. So it's kind of a funny structure, because the Europeans actually are a protectorate empire of the American empire, because the American troops are still staying there to make sure that, you know, the Europeans behave. So they're going to be a protectorate, but from the perspective of the Europeans, they're actually the ones who really have the sort of philosophical, social sophistication to really be able to tell the Americans what to do with all that might as they rule the world. So it actually, if you can believe this, it's actually kind of like the Middle Ages, because you have the Europeans are like the Pope. They're like the spiritual, they've got like the all the Kantian vision, and they're like the experts and the international legal experts and the moral experts, and they're telling the whole world morally how to behave. And then we've got, you know, we've got like the Americans. They're like the tough-minded, you know, imperial guys, and they think, oh, these Europeans, they don't have the faintest idea how to run the world. This is just like the Middle Ages. If you want to understand the Middle Ages, the emperors sat around thinking, wow, these popes have no idea how to run the world. And the popes sat around thinking, these emperors are like barbarians. They don't know how to run the world. And this is it. This is going to be the new project. But everybody agrees there's going to be an international rule of law. And what does that mean? That means that countries that used to be independent nations, well, now there's going to be somebody who's going to decide where that independence ends. There was disagreement about who's going to decide exactly. So sometimes they thought that the United Nations would decide. Sometimes they decided, well, the United Nations can't decide. So NATO's going to decide. Sometimes they decided, well, NATO can't decide, so it's going to be one of a number of courts in Europe. All sorts of options for who's going to decide. But one thing's really clear is that if you don't play by the rules, which is the way they started talking, like there's like these rules for how the world works, and we Americans and Europeans, we know how the world rules work, and if you don't play by the rules, then we're going to come and get you. Okay, this is the old imperial order. Now, I don't pretend that there are no advantages to this. Okay, I spoke in the previous session about the failure of the Americans and the British to bomb the railroad tracks during World War II. And I would like to think that that somewhere, someplace, that lesson has been learned, that if someone has the power to bomb the railroad tracks, and it doesn't matter whether it's Jews or whether it's in Rwanda, and hundreds of thousands of people are being killed and millions of people stand to die, that somebody would try to interfere. Okay, so I'm with them that far. But there's a big difference between a vision of a new world order where somebody somewhere is going to decide how every country in the world, like exactly what kind of human rights regime they're going to have and what kind of democracy they're going to have and what's acceptable and what's not acceptable and how they fight their wars and are they fighting the wars properly. And then it turns out that every time that some war breaks out between two countries or two groups or a civil war, so somebody in Brussels or Washington is going to think that they're smart enough to know exactly who's right and to what extent in these local wars. This looks kind of crazy to me. That's my view. When we got to 2016, we had a backlash against this. I'm not saying that means that, you know, anyone should necessarily cheer Brexit or cheer the Trump administration. And I don't know what's going to happen in the coming years. There can be all sorts of directions that this is going to go. But I think we do need to get our principles right. Okay, I do think we need to have that debate that we never had. For a whole generation, we never had this debate. And now we have a chance to have this debate. Is it really better for the world to be governed by one imperial order, however defined, however understood, a liberal international order, as it's often called? Or is it actually best, is the world best governed when it's governed as a world of independent national states, what we call nationalism, a nationalist political order, a nationalist political theory? As Jews, as Christians, as unaffiliated people who live in a civilization that was formed to a very significant degree by the Hebrew Bible, one of the sources, one of the central sources that we have for thinking about this issue is our biblical tradition. And this biblical tradition is one that, because we don't talk about it very much, because academics and intellectuals are very much in the mindset that goes, well, really, we left all the religious stuff. The Bible is religion, and religion is the Dark Ages, and we left all that stuff behind. And now we live in this new secular enlightened world where everybody just, you know, used reason and figured things out, and the American Constitution and the French Revolution and the Universal Declaration of the Rights of Man and the UN Charter, and you could just keep naming these things, and you'll meet people of different political persuasions, and they all sort of say, you know, variations on the same thing. Whether they call themselves liberals or call themselves conservatives, they say variations on the same thing. That thank goodness we all figured it out somewhere around 1776, and now all we need to do is figure out how to implement it. All right, this was most famously Francis Fukuyama. History is ended. History is ended. Right, but you know, those of you who are conservatives, you should immediately be suspicious when some conservative starts quoting Hegel about the end of history. Right? Hegel, I mean, you understand what we're talking about? They're saying that the French Revolution, Hegel was saying that the French Revolution was the moment where history, mankind achieved the pinnacle. We don't have any more thinking to do. Now it's all just implementation. The French Revolution, that's conservatism? Are you kidding me? Okay, but that's just me. I know that some people are wondering about the way that the word liberalism is being used. Okay, liberal internationalism. And, you know, there is a shift taking place where the liberals, the internationalists, the globalists, have named themselves liberal internationalists. That's the name they use. And the nationalists are, in an important sense, conservative. They're the conservatives. I actually think that's a reasonable usage of the terms, but I understand that that's not the way people are necessarily used to it. All right, so let's just think about that for one moment. I've talked about Locke and other early modern rationalist thinkers who used the social contract and universal reason in order to paint a picture of what I called the liberal world. The question is, what happens to it later? Okay, so that's early modern. So maybe it'll surprise you, but many significant liberal thinkers, right? There are definitely liberal thinkers who I described as being kind of like, they take Lockean liberalism, but they mix it with other principles. They make it more common sense and more balanced. That's more true in the Anglo-Saxon world than it is in Europe. In Europe, they tend to take the stuff straight, like unmixed. But the tradition that we today, even if you're saying, be specific, not liberalism in general, all the descendants of Locke, but I want to be more specific. I want to talk about what sometimes is called classical liberalism today. So who's a classical liberal? I want to make sure we understand each other. The greatest mind who's associated with classical liberalism in the 20th century is Friedrich Hayek. Okay, and he deserves his reputation as a brilliant, not only an economist, but as a thinker. Friedrich Hayek takes the implicitly imperialistic, universal liberal idea And he makes it explicitly about world order, okay? The international universal world federation, which in 1989 becomes like the official political theory of both America and Europe, plus minus, that's a view that Hayek was endorsing. He's in the 1930s, right? He's already in his 40s, and a significant thinker. And he writes, "The abrogation of national sovereignties and the creation of an effective international order of law is a necessarily complement and the logical consummation of the liberal program. The idea of interstate federation is the consistent development of the liberal point of view." Okay, now this is in an essay. The entire essay is devoted to showing how free market economics, right? And I've been a free marketer ever since I read Free to Choose by Milton Friedman when I was 19 years old, my whole life. And I haven't swerved from it. Okay, but here, what Hayek is doing in this essay is he's saying, if you want there to be maximally effective markets, then you can't have obstacles of the kind that are created when you have permanent national associations. And so all the boundaries have to go down. And all the boundaries have to go down. It's not a conservative position anymore, right? This is a liberal position. And he doesn't say it's a conservative position. It's what he calls, it's the consistent development of the liberal point of view. We're going to take all the boundaries down. We're going to prevent there from being stable, consistent groupings of loyalties that affect the market. And as a consequence, we will optimize the performance of the market on Earth. Right? That's Hayek. And so it's not a coincidence that Hayek says in the Constitution of Liberty that he's not a conservative. He's not a conservative. He's a liberal. I want another example. What about Mises? When I was in college and I was fighting the Reagan Revolution, there was this business group that was funding. I founded this magazine at Princeton called the Princeton Tory. Okay, and so the Princeton Tory is getting supported by you know, one of these conservative business groups. And I got in the mail a book from them, very thoughtful. They're sending out to all of their, you know, the people they're supporting. And the book was called Liberalism by Mises, you know, one of the towering figures of classical liberalism. And I started leafing through this. I couldn't believe I was reading this. I just couldn't believe it. Mises is writing in favor of, quote, "a world superstate really deserving of the name that would be capable of assuring the nations of the peace that they require." A world superstate worthy? What, you surely, you must have the wrong address. Like, what, are you, you're kidding me? Here's another quote from Mises, from the same book, Liberalism. "The greatest ideological question that mankind has ever faced is a question of whether we shall succeed in creating throughout the world a frame of mind of nothing less than the unqualified, unconditional acceptance of liberalism. Liberal thinking must permeate all nations. Liberal principles must pervade all political institutions if the prerequisites of peace are to be created and the causes of war eliminated." Now, holy smokes. These people are rationalist utopians. You remember that essay by Oakeshott, like rationalism in politics? Like conservatives are supposed to be like skeptical of like big theoretical frameworks that are universal. I mean, this stuff is exactly the kind of utopian flattening thinking that the entire planet fits into my mathematical model and it's got to be like that, that I was always taught that conservatives are against. And here it is. And you're sending me this book. Now look, there really is such a thing as liberalism, and it has different branches, and some of them are called conservative today, and some of them are called liberal today, and they have all sorts of names. It's all going to get itself straightened out, but for our purposes, this view that we were just listening to, that the world has to be one way because we've got all the answers. Right? This is the alternative to what I've proposed as nationalism, which I think is a biblical view, which has been developed over thousands of years in different directions. Two directions that are particularly important for us to consider when we're trying to figure out what's our view, a world of national states or this world super state thing or global governance thing that Mises and Hayek are talking about, the World Federation. So one is the Anglo-American conservative tradition. And when I speak about the Anglo-American conservative tradition, I'm not talking about something that was born in 1776. Okay, I'm talking about a very old tradition of which the American Constitution is a crucial instance and development, and the American Bill of Rights is a crucial instance and development, but these are things that are developments of the earlier English Constitution, the English traditional Constitution, the English Petition of Right and Bill of Rights, which are part of American history, they're part of that tradition, and they themselves are built on earlier thinkers, right? Going back to the beginning of Protestantism and into Catholicism, into thinkers like Fortescue, right? Who I mentioned as constructing, understanding that the English tradition is built upon a biblical tradition, and specifically an Old Testament tradition. What's the content of this Anglo-American tradition? Okay, now you'll notice I may be using liberalism in a way that's not exactly the way you're used to it. I might also be using conservatism in a way that you're not used to it. There are writers like Oakeshott who think that conservatism is like a state of mind. It's like a predisposition to just like things the way they are. And I've never found any attraction to this way of thinking. It's certainly not biblical. You think the prophets of Israel just like things the way they are? Ha! No. The departure from Egypt is a revolutionary move. Right? The destruction of Sodom is a revolutionary move. There are moments in history where a revolutionary move is the only move that's possible. The invasion of Canaan is a revolutionary move. Okay, so I don't know. I don't think that all situations, no matter how bad they are, no matter how evil they are, no matter how terrible they are, deserve to remain in place. The American invasion of the South and the dismantling of slavery is a revolutionary move. And I think I would hope that if it were my decision to make, that that's the decision I would have made. Not everything is good the way it is. So that's not conservatism to me. So what is conservatism? What interests me in this Anglo-American conservative tradition is the consistency over, something like 5, 6, 7, 8 centuries of a set of principles that you can actually trace through all that time in England and in America. And those principles, I don't mean that everybody accepted them, but at least one party or one group, the conservatives, supported this. So what are those principles? I'm going to name 5 principles. And I consider this to be, look, this is not a catechism. This is not doctrine. It's not intended to be exhaustive or perfect. It's an attempt to grasp a huge, huge body of thought over many, many centuries. And I think I do a pretty good job, but not perfect, all right? Five principles. First, historical empiricism. This is the opposite of rationalism. Historical empiricism means that for conservatives, for people like Fortescue or Coke or John Selden or Burke or Hamilton or Washington, you know what? Also for Margaret Thatcher, it's not about some kind of mathematical system that we've rationally proven and now it's all going to be implemented. History is one big long series of experiments, and each nation through its life conducts experiments to the right or to the left. It makes changes. Sometimes it makes mistakes. It goes back. Nations learn and they grow. So the conservative love of the tradition and what we've inherited is not, as Selden emphasizes, not because we believe everything that's handed down to us. Selden is absolutely adamant about this. It's not because we believe everything that's handed down to us. It's because we are not smart enough ourselves to figure everything out. And so we use our tradition, we look back over the centuries, and we see the things that were tried, what was tried and what succeeded, what was tried and what failed. And when we have an institution and we see that it is working now, first of all, we think centuries and centuries of our forefathers, the best minds of our people, struggled with these problems and left records of it and created this system this way. And I would want to be really, really careful before I start blowing up pieces of it because I think I'm so smart that I've got some new way of doing everything. Because the entire thing might go. All right, so the first part is historical empiricism, the first principle. We learn from the past. We learn from the deep past. And the traditions bring the past to us and help us learn. That's why we need to study the traditions. And we can't just lose them. We can't just say, oh, you know, we began again in 1989 with a new world. We began again in the recreation of the Civil War, the founding of 1776. I mean, all these things are true, but they're also false. Because all of these are moments of inheritance of a past. And we need to know that past. If Americans don't know the English past, and they don't know the biblical past, they don't know their own past, because they don't know what was tried, and they don't know what worked. They don't know where they came from, how it happened, how they think, the way they think, and why. They don't know the reasons. They start thinking all sorts of funny things. Second principle, which is closely related to the first, is nationalism. Right? Even the England of Fortescue, which is still Catholic, you read In Praise of the Laws of England, and every page of it breathes the spirit of English nationalism. It's all about, look at England, look at Germany, look at France. Each nation has different kinds of customs, different kinds of laws, different needs, different things that fit to it. And nevertheless, let me explain to you why the English laws are better than any others. Right? This nationalism is both an understanding of the crucial need of each people to be able to determine its own fate, its own conditions, its own way of thinking, and at the same time, an ability to see, well, let's compare. Maybe ours is better. You know what? But maybe somebody else's is better. Let's see. And that can only happen when you're a nationalist. Third principle, religion. Okay, really I should be saying Christianity. Really I should be saying Protestantism, if I'm focusing on the Anglo-American tradition. But, you know, as I said, nations can add tribes, they can make some changes, they can try and see how it happens. Maybe you're going to add Catholics, maybe you're going to add Jews. I don't want to answer these questions right now. This is obviously what happened. Let's just say, for the moment, religion. Okay, and we'll try to figure out exactly what religion. I mean, the truth is there's no, even the English tradition is federalist about religion, right? I mean, the British, when the Americans revolted against the British, the British had a Church of England in England, and they had a Church of Scotland in Scotland, and they had a Church of Ireland in Ireland, which means that they were federalists about religion. Okay, so they had an established church, but they were federalists about religion. Right, so when you think about the American model, don't think that it's so necessarily so far from that. Religion has a central place in all conservative thought. Now, when I say all, you can point to important exceptions, of course. Anthony Quinton is an important historian of conservatism from Oxford, died a few years ago, wrote a history of English conservatism in which he sees that conservatism grows out of Fortescue and Hooker and the common law treaty. He sees that clearly, but he also wants to say, look, there's a, because he himself is a secularist. He really doesn't like the established church, and he'd prefer to get rid of it, even though he's a conservative. So he doesn't like this principle. So he says, look, let's take a Tory like David Hume, right? And David Hume, he's a really good historical empiricist, right? He fits great into the conservative tradition. He's a Tory. He can't stand, you know, revolutions. He loves freedom, but a real conservative in a whole host of ways. Just, you know, that he thinks religion is, you know, a little bit overrated. And I agree with Quinton that that we definitely should, because this is not dogma, right? So this principle of religion, there definitely are important skeptical thinkers within on the borders of conservatism who are like Hume, who are not religious. But the overwhelming mainstream of Anglo-American conservatism understands its biblical roots, understands its religious tradition as a centerpiece for the way that society has to be governed and the way that government has to see itself. Now, this is not just England that has an established church. This is also in America, where until the 1930s, the Supreme Court was still saying that America is a Christian nation. Okay, it's really just not that long ago. I mean, the talk about defending Christian values is still going on in World War II. Roosevelt and Churchill are still talking about the West as a Christian civilization.
The preservation of these rights is vitally important now, not only to us who enjoy them, but to the whole future of Christian civilization.
It's very, very, very recent. It's a brand new, almost, experiment. It's two generations to start thinking that we can have conservatism without God and without the Bible and without religious tradition at the center of it. A newfangled thing. I don't know. Maybe it'll work. I don't think so. I don't think it's working at all. Okay, so I'm going to leave it in for now. All right, religion, public religion, not just private personal religion, public religion of some kind. Religion in the public square, Americans like to say. Public religion that forms the society, that government's in favor of, that government supports in some ways and maybe in others. Fourth principle, limited executive power. We've talked a lot about it. I'm not going to belabor the point. You understand what that means. That freedom, first and foremost, comes with the biblical idea that the king has to be limited by other powers. That there has to be some kind of separation between the powers of the executive and other powers which limit and balance it. That's the fourth principle. And the fifth principle, individual freedoms. Okay, individual freedoms you can also trace from the Bible, but certainly that is the bulwark of when you're reading Fortescue. And I hope you'll all read Fortescue. It's really, really important. When you're reading Fortescue and you're reading somebody who wrote in the 1470s, like, you think it's a different planet. Reading him, it's like reading somebody who could be writing today when he's talking about how the English Constitution and the English laws protect the freedom and the liberties of the individual Englishman better than anything else that exists in the world. Read it, you won't believe it. It's from 1470. It reads like, you know, it could be from out of a debate today. And he bases it on the Bible. So those are my five principles. right, that I'm proposing for the Anglo-American conservative tradition. And I suggest that when we think about nationalism, we think about a world of independent nations. Look, some of those nations are going to be, in our opinion, terribly misguided. China doesn't govern itself the way that I think that China should be governed. But you know what? France doesn't govern itself the way I think it should be governed. The problem is that I don't think, and here we come to this historical empiricism point again, is that I'm just not a rationalist. I don't think that my brain is smart enough to figure out how every single thing in the world should be run, much less to make them do it now. Okay, so I want to focus on something closer to home, something that worked terrifically well, this Anglo-American tradition. I want to focus on that, and I want to make sure that we're not like throwing principles away, because what worked for 500 or 600 or 800 years in England and then in America, what worked was these five principles together. Okay, now if you're going to come and tell me that there's something called liberal democracy, okay, which is a term that was coined, as far as I can tell, it became popular in Germany and Italy in the 1920s, 30s. Right, this is a new term. It's not like the founding fathers went around going, yes, liberal democracy is what we believe in. It's a new term that intellectuals from Europe came up with, and it's been important. It's become really popular in the English-speaking world in the last generation, really, really popular. So, okay, I don't mind using new labels for old things. If what you mean by liberal democracy is these five principles, then I'll support it, but that's not what I see. What I see is that liberal democracy works like this. Principle 5, individual freedoms. Yep, my brain says yes. We're going to take that, run with it. Principle 4, limited executive power. Yep, my brain says yes. Let's run with that. Principle 3, religion. Well, you know, religion, you know, maybe if it's really private, you know, as long as it's separated from government, as long as I don't have to see it, you know. In other words, no. Principle 3, no. No public religion. That's not liberal democracy. We know that. Principle 2, nationalism. Well, you know, as long as it's enlightened, as long as it's an enlightened nationalism, as long as sovereignty, you know, just means limited sovereignty, and, you know, as long as we're interconnected, and it's the age of the internet, and we're all together, you know, deciding everything together, you know, with our allies, we'll have leadership, but we'll decide together, and at the UN sometimes, and nationalism, no, just no, not like Yoram means, you know, not like. No. Historical empiricism. Yeah, that sounds good. You know, we conservatives, we're empiricists. We're Anglo-Americans. You know, we're definitely empiricists, right? But we know that human rights are, you know, universal. You know, we know that. We figured out what the rights are, and we know that they need to happen everywhere. And we know how the economy is supposed to work everywhere. And so we could have, like, you know, so what would be wrong, since it's universal, of having like one, you know, like a body, like a judicial body that decides on rights everywhere, or an economic body like the World Trade Organization that decides on trade policy everywhere on the face of the planet? Wait a second. Where's the empiricism? Where's the world of experiments? Like, where's trying different things and having them compete with one another? I thought that that was supposed to be conservative. But it's not anymore. Not for a lot of people. For a lot of people, conservatism is just a rationalist set of propositions. Here's the list. You believe in this, this, and this, and that's it. So actually, this liberal democracy that some people are calling conservative and some people are calling liberal democracy, it's a little bit confusing. actually what they're doing is they're taking five out of the five principles of the Anglo-American conservative tradition, they're willing to endorse two of them. And then they want to say to me, what's with you? Get with the program. You're not a conservative. What's your problem? Why are you complaining? Okay, so my proposal. There are five principles. These principles have been our principles for centuries and centuries and centuries. And if you want to give up on them, I'd like to see some experimentation. I'd like to see you going places and seeing what happens when you give up on them. And I'll tell you a secret. America and England are like on the fast track to giving up on, were for a whole generation. We did this experiment sort of, right? For a whole generation or two, we were on the fast track to giving up on three out of the five conservative principles. And you know what? I don't like what I saw. Maybe you do. But I think that's the discussion we need to be having. That's the discussion we need to be having. I think this Anglo-American tradition has been really, really good to Britain, to America, and to the world. And I think that we need to, in the context of thinking about nationalism, we need to think about what is American nationalism, what is British nationalism, what is the thing that these countries are going to pursue and offer the world. And I think it's this. I think it's these five principles. I think that this is the model that the Anglos offered the world that so many people are trying to learn from, but they're not really so successful because they don't necessarily understand it. Or maybe it just can't be imitated in their countries. All right, I think that's a really good contribution of English and American or British and American nationalism. The other thing, the other nationalism is Jewish nationalism. And Jewish nationalism is also a complicated thing. I'm not going to try to reduce it to principles at the moment, although you could probably, you know, lots of people have tried. And I'm sure that I could offer mine. But for the moment, let's just say that the tradition that goes from the Hebrew Bible through the rabbinic tradition to Zionism and the modern Jewish state, right? There is such a tradition. It's not the same as the Anglo-American tradition. It doesn't have all of the same values. You know, there are things maybe that we can learn from the Anglo-American tradition, I'm sure. And there may be things that the Jewish tradition has to teach Britain and America. And I actually feel that more and more with every passing year. Now, these two traditions, the Anglo-American tradition and the Jewish Zionist tradition, these two political traditions, they're different forms of nationalism. They're different experiments in how human beings should live. They've each contributed remarkable things to the world, and God willing, they will each continue to contribute remarkable things to the world. And all of them, all three of them, I mean the British, the American, the Israeli version, we could name others, but we're running out of time, so we're not going to name others today. These three traditions, the one thing above everything else that I think is important to reconnect with is the way in which they grow out of the Bible. They grow out of Hebrew scripture. They grow out of the words of the prophets and the writings of Moses. And this is something people knew once. And it's something that we can know again. We don't have to just keep forgetting, which is not only ungrateful, but not prudent. They grow out of the Bible, our Bible, this incredible book that shaped the world. And it all began with God telling Abraham to leave his country and the house of his father and to go to a land where God would make him a great nation, make him a great nation. Esecha legoy gadol, I'll make of you a great nation. V'nivrechu v'cha kol mishpachot Adama. And in you and your great nation, all the families of the earth will be blessed. Now that is how I understand Jewish nationalism.